Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo, and it is with great pride and eager anticipation that I extend this first welcome to the 2012 festival season, Music at Menlo's 10th anniversary. This season, we explore the power of music from the listener's perspective. How does music affect us? How do we use it? What does it mean to us? Over the course of 8 concert programs surveying music's various powers, from the animation of dance and drama to the deepest nourishment of the soul, this season meditates on the simple and audacious question, what is music for? We've entitled the season Resonance to reflect the deep fundamental exploration of music that we look forward to taking with you this summer. Just as the sound of music depends on the resonance of physical objects, our experience of it as listeners is defined by the emotional resonance it inspires. Music resonates not only in our ears, but in our hearts and minds, and affects us in ways that are impossible to capture in words. It is this strange and marvelous dimension of music that we celebrate this season at Music at Menlo. As in previous seasons, this year's installment of Audio Notes brings you in-depth discussions of the music you'll be hearing at the festival. I'll be joined by Artistic Co-Director Wu Han, Music at Menlo's Artistic Administrator Patrick Castillo, and a few of this season's festival artists who will take you deep inside the music and prepare you for the rewarding musical experience that our audiences have come to expect over the last 10 years. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you at the concerts.
Concert Program 5, Motivated, celebrates the vital dimension of dance in the musical art form across more than 2 centuries. From the second orchestral suite of Johann Sebastian Bach, a collection of traditional Baroque dance forms, to Aaron Copland's iconic ballet Appalachian Spring. Along the way, Schubert's rustic 6 German dances and the Emperor Waltz of the Waltz King Johann Strauss Jr., in a decadent arrangement by Arno Schoenberg, illustrates the vitality of dance in 19th century Vienna. While Debussy's impressionistic, sacred, and profane dances and Bartok's Romanian folk dances encapsulate those composers' native cultures.
In 1723, Johann Sebastian Bach was appointed to the music directorships of the Nikolaikirche and the Paulinerkirche, the 2 most prominent churches in Leipzig, as well as to the post of cantor of the St. Thomas School at Leipzig's Thomaskirche. These prestigious appointments lured him from his position as Kapellmeister at the court of Köthen to the city where he would remain until his death in 1750. Also during his tenure in Leipzig, Bach assumed the directorship of the Collegium Musicum, a strong amateur ensemble founded in 1701 by Bach's contemporary, Georg Philipp Telemann. The Collegium Musicum was one of numerous such performance groups in Germany at the time, mostly founded by university music students, and which were a vital part of German musical life. Much of Bach's instrumental music during this period was composed for the Collegium Musicum's performances at such venues as Zimmermann's Kaffeehaus, a café made famous for hosting the premier performances of some of Bach's finest music. Bach's 4 orchestral suites are among the works presented at Zimmermann's Kaffeehaus by the Collegium Musicum. The second of these, the Orchestral Suite No. 2 in B minor, was the last of the 4 to be completed. Its composition dates from between 1738 and 1739, though recent research suggests that some of its material comes from Bach's earlier time in Köthen. Bach's directorship of the Collegium Musicum, in addition to his various other posts, helped reinforce his position as Leipzig's most influential musical figure. More importantly, it provided Bach, one of history's most indefatigable composers, with an outlet to produce a body of secular instrumental music not needed for his church positions, but that over history have become essential to the Western canon. The Orchestral Suite No. 2 in B minor is scored for solo flute, strings, and continuo, and represents an important part of the flute repertoire. Each of the orchestral suites begins with an overture. The B minor suite's overture is set in the French style, characterized by its stately dotted rhythm opening.
It's very bold, the French overture. It's in your face.
Flautist Carol Wissens.
It's the weight and the depth of the overture, which then transitions into this beautiful allegro movement, which is part of the overture, and in alla breve. So it's the tempo marking is suggesting that it's very deft and that it's moving.
As per the French overture style, the regal opening leads to a central fugato section. Following the overtures, the orchestral suites are compendia of Baroque dance forms. The second movement is a rondo, a French dance form rooted in the early 13th century.
Then there's a beautiful rondo, and the tease that he does rhythmically is that he never puts it on the beat. It's not da-dum, beam, ba-dum, ba, but it's dee-dum, bum, dee-dum, ba, yum.
The third movement is a saraband, a genre of sung dance form from 16th century Spain.
So all these dance forms were no longer being danced during Bach's time, but dance forms coming out of the Renaissance. Well, we don't really have anything quite like that in the repertoire. The saraband, for example, is so grippingly beautiful.
Following the dolorous saraband comes the lively bourrée, another French dance form. The movement includes a second contrasting bourrée, which spotlights the flute above a sparser ensemble accompaniment. Next comes the polonaise, a stately Polish dance in triple meter. Thank you. The minuet, another triple meter dance, resembles the elegant gait of a waltz. This form would remain a key component of instrumental music throughout the classical period, serving as the second or third movement in the multi-movement works of Haydn and Mozart. The suite concludes with its most famous movement, the sprightly badinerie. The term badinerie, or badinage, came into use around the time of this suite, and according to the New Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians, the finale to Bach's B minor suite is the only known badinerie in the repertoire. The term has no exact musical definition. It was generally used to describe music of a light and frivolous character. Whether frivolous or profound, as with all of Bach's music, the execution is impeccable. And for the solo flautist, the badinerie offers one of the classic tunes in that instrument's repertoire. The program continues with Franz Schubert's Six German Dances for solo piano. Schubert composed this short and irresistible set in October of 1824. The dances are each between 1 and 2 minutes long and are played without pause, and feel more like a single movement work in 6 episodes than a collection of 6 dances. They are sweet, delectable miniatures, placing the listener in the 19th century Viennese salons, where much of Schubert's music was first heard. The next work on Concert Program 5 takes a more abstract look at the concept of music and dance. While not strictly based on any particular dance forms, Claude Debussy's Danses Sacrées et Profanes, or Sacred and Profane Dances, nevertheless demonstrate the rhythmic vitality and immediacy of character that are at the center of any music used for dance. Debussy composed the dances in 1904 on a commission from the instrument manufacturer Pleyel. The company had recently introduced the chromatic harp and was seeking repertoire for the new instrument. A conventional harp is tuned to the diatonic major scale. In other words, its strings are tuned only to the pitches A, B, C, D, E, F, and G. And then there's a set of 7 pedals, which flatten or sharpen each pitch. So, if you want to play an A flat, for example, there's a pedal that turns every A string into an A flat. Watching a harpist play a heavily chromatic piece can be as astonishing for the footwork involved as for the fingerwork. So in 1897, Pleyel introduced the chromatic harp, which had separate strings for all 12 pitches and no pedals. Debussy composed his Sacred and Profane Dances for this instrument and designed it as an exam piece for students at the Brussels Conservatoire. Well, the chromatic harp never really caught on and has long since been abandoned, but the Sacred and Profane Dances quickly became one of the most popular works in the harp repertoire and are still widely performed today on the conventional harp. The sacred dance emerges quietly and mysteriously, as if from some primordial state. The harp enters with a tranquil series of chords. Debussy's modal harmonies evoke an aura of antiquity, perhaps in deference to the harp, one of the most ancient instruments.
Debussy was definitely doing a lot of things with this piece.
Harpist Bridget Kibbe.
And it's funny, it's kind of a paradox because he was actually writing for the newly minted chromatic harp, as well as looking back to ancient languages and kind of creating this look back to ancient Greece in the first dance, Danse Sacrée. So I think that listeners can really enjoy kind of the austere, almost, it almost sounds like a Gregorian chant-like feeling of the first movement. And I think what also makes the piece so special is, you know, he is showcasing the chromaticism of the harp. And so you'll definitely see the harpist tap dancing as she shifts pedals very frequently to move in a very chromatic fashion. But more than anything else, I think that Debussy is really a master of color, and he very much exploits and showcases the fantastic color range of the harp through this piece. So it might start with very calm, transparent colors between the harp and the strings, but then it continues to have such incredible, vibrant, lush, rich colors that you can often associate with the harp. So he really covers such a wide color range in the entire piece.
Whole tone figurations later in the dance reinforce the music's unearthly quality. After the featherweight sacred dance, which seems to just float above ground, the profane dance establishes a steady waltz-like tempo, an earthly quality that contrasts the sacred character of the first dance. The Viennese composer and conductor Johann Strauss Jr. was responsible for some of the most wildly popular music of 19th century Vienna, and indeed what remains some of the most popular music in the repertoire today. He lived from 1825 to 1899 and was the son of the celebrated composer Johann Strauss I. During his lifetime, he was known variously as Strauss the Son or Strauss the Younger, but it's by another nickname that Strauss is more fondly known. To legions of music lovers, Johann Strauss Jr. is the Waltz King. Strauss made his public debut as a composer and conductor at the age of 18, and his music immediately met with public acclaim. Referring to the elder Johann Strauss, the press proclaimed, quote, "Strauss's name will be worthily continued in his son. Children and children's children can look forward to the future, and three-quarter time will find a strong footing in him," end quote. Three-quarter time, referring, of course, to the triple meter of waltz music. Indeed, Strauss's waltzes would become emblematic of Viennese dance music. Owing largely to those enchanting waltzes, Strauss the Younger's popularity continued to grow, and in 1852, the Viennese press declared, quote, "Strauss the father has been fully replaced by Strauss the son," End quote. Strauss was greatly prolific and commercially shrewd. Any significant event in Viennese public life, as well as many important occasions elsewhere in Europe, was commemorated by a festive Strauss waltz, ensuring that the composer remained always in the public eye. Strauss scholar Peter Kemp writes, quote, "The titles and dedicatees of Strauss's compositions may be viewed as a musically illustrated guide to about 50 years of European history." End quote. Though he's regarded, not inaccurately, as a composer of lighter fare, it would be a mistake to dismiss Strauss as a composer lacking in substance. Despite the lack of any gravitas in his own music, he was fascinated by the progressive musical innovations of Richard Wagner and Franz Liszt, and his own keen instinct for melody and instrumental color won the admiration of such quote-unquote serious composers as Brahms, Richard Strauss, Verdi, and Wagner. Today, it surprises many listeners that the iconoclastic composers of the Second Viennese School likewise held Strauss's music in quite high regard. Arnold Schoenberg, Anton Webern, and Alban Berg even made arrangements of Strauss waltzes for the Society for Private Musical Performances, an organization founded by Schoenberg in 1918 to champion what he saw as the finest examples of modern music. One of the most delectable of these is Schoenberg's arrangement of Strauss's Kaiserwalzer, or Emperor Waltz, for flute, clarinet, string quartet, and piano. The Hungarian composer Béla Bartók ranks alongside the likes of Debussy, Stravinsky, and Schoenberg as one of the most original and influential composers of the 20th century. His viscerally compelling musical language drew from a wide range of influences, from Bach and Beethoven to his own contemporaries and even American jazz. But the aspect of Bartók's art that's of most lasting significance is his interest in and avid championship of Eastern European folk music. Bartók is generally regarded as history's first ethnomusicologist. He traveled extensively throughout the Eastern European countryside, listening to and recording Hungarian, Romanian, and Slovak peasant music. And his deep study of this music was the most important influence on his own work. His absorption of peasant music and his integration of it into his own scores are what truly distinguish Bartók's musical language and have established him as the central figure of modern Hungarian music. The Romanian folk dances, composed in 1915, are as clear a demonstration of the influence of Eastern European folk music on Bartók's music as anything he composed. Though Bartók typically simulated the character of folk music in his pieces, rather than appropriating actual folk tunes, these six dances derive directly from fiddle tunes that he heard and recorded. The first movement, identified as a stick dance, takes its theme from a tune introduced to Bartók by a gypsy violinist in Transylvania. The following movement is called, simply, sash dance, for the waistband that would traditionally have been worn by the dancer. Mm-hmm. Perhaps the most exotic sounding of the dances is the third of the set, entitled In One Spot. Following a slow hornpipe dance and a Romanian polka, the set concludes with a thrilling finale called, straightforwardly enough, Fast Dance. Aaron Copland owns a legacy as one of the United States' most seminal composers. Born in Brooklyn, New York, in 1900 to Russian Jewish immigrant parents, Copland lived and worked during the formative years of America's musical development. Charles Ives, the innovative patriarch of American music, was 26 years old and nearing his artistic maturity when Copland was born. Another revolutionary American composer, Henry Cowell, was just 3 years Copland senior. And over the course of his own fruitful career, Copland served as a mentor to many definitive American composers, including William Schumann, Leonard Bernstein, Lucas Foss, Elliot Carter, and others. He furthermore worked tirelessly to nurture the growth of an American musical community. In addition to composing, Copland produced concerts, wrote extensively on music, oversaw the publication of new works by American composers, and in 1939 co-founded the American Music Center, an important service and resource center for classical music in the United States. But above all, it is through his compositional activities that Copland garnered the honorary moniker of Dean of American Music. In searching for a distinctly American musical language, he integrated elements of jazz, blues, and other popular American styles with the characteristics of those composers whom he most revered: the modernism of Stravinsky, the textures of Gabriel Fauré and Gustav Mahler. Intrepidly curious, he even tinkered with Schoenberg's 12-tone method in his piano quartet of 1950. Appalachian Spring, a one-act ballet composed in 1944 for Martha Graham, is one of Copland's most renowned scores and garnered the 1945 Pulitzer Prize for Music. The music is originally scored for an ensemble of 13 instruments. Copland also prepared an orchestral version, and both remain popular and frequently performed today. In addition to arguably becoming Copland's most popular piece, Appalachian Spring is widely regarded as a quintessentially American work. The sound world that Copland creates resonates with many listeners as the signature sound of American music.
The use of open fourths, fifths in harmonic language, there's no question it has that fresh American bring it on spirit to it.
Flautist Carol Winsense.
It is uniquely our own. It's very interesting. And I think probably it comes from church tradition, you know, hymnal tradition. Because when you sing four-part harmony in our American church settings, you know, we're hearing that. We're hearing those open intervals. It's a part of the simplicity of design. If you think about early American furniture or paintings, You get that simplicity, you get that organization, you get that very subtle use of expressivity. This is very symmetrical music, even though Copland, in his highly adventurous way, in terms of language, there's harmonic language, there's rhythmic language, and he'll get jaunty, and he'll throw in that oddball beat, or that kind of blue note, you know, which is also coming from a jazz tradition. Copland is just totally comfortable with the swing element, the beautiful open harmonies, you know, the subtlety of switching from harmony to disharmony and bringing it around again summing it up, making it organized, tying it in a nice, neat bow. And also the language in the writing, he never uses Italian terms, very rarely. It's all in Americanese, you know, flowingly, without rushing, or there are certain ways that he expresses how to take time or how to move forward.
The ballet depicts the story of 19th century pioneers and their springtime celebration after building a farmhouse for a young couple soon to wed. The other central characters are the young couple's neighbor, a revivalist preacher, and his congregation. Copland provided descriptions of each of the score's 8 sections. The music begins with a slow and peaceful introduction. Copland writes, quote, "Introduction of the characters, one by one, in a suffused light," end quote. This launches soon into a spirited passage. Copland writes, quote, "Sudden burst of unison strings in A major arpeggios starts the action. A sentiment both elated and religious gives the keynote to this scene," end quote. Next comes the duo for the bride and her intended, which Copland describes as, quote, "a scene of tenderness and passion," end quote. Copland paints the scene in warm colors, using the bassoon and strings, highlighted by the rounded timbre of the clarinet. The pace quickens for the scene depicting the revivalist and his flock. Copland marks the music to be played with a, quote, "folksy feeling, suggestions of square dances and country fiddlers," end quote. The music grows faster yet for the solo dance of the bride. Copland writes, quote, "presentiment of motherhood, extremes of joy and fear and wonder," end quote. A brief transition recalls the idyllic character of the slow introduction. The seventh scene contains the most famous music of the ballet, a set of variations on a Shaker hymn. Copland writes, quote, "Scenes of daily activity for the bride and her former husband. There are five variations on a Shaker theme. The theme, sung by a solo clarinet, was taken from a collection of Shaker melodies compiled by Edward D. Andrews and published under the title The Gift to be Simple. The melody most borrowed and used almost literally is called Simple Gifts." End quote. Copland's variations on this theme grow increasingly animated, culminating in the ballet's radiant climax. The ballet ends with the bride taking her place among her neighbors. Copland writes, quote, "At the end, the couple are left quiet and strong in their new house. Muted strings intone a hushed, prayer-like chorale passage." End quote. Carol Winsense.
It pulls on you. How many times have I listened to Appalachian Spring and completely well up with tears? It somehow conjures up every longing, every heartbreak, every blissful love relationship, every parent who adores their child, who can't believe their every move. This is the kind of music this is. It's so touching. It's like holding an infant and you're staring at it and you're saying, oh my gosh, I'm holding this infant. I don't want to drop the baby, you know, and this is the way this music is. You can't overdo it. If you overdo it, it kills it, it crushes it, and you can't underdo it because it's so direct. It is. It's very childlike. Maybe that's the word I've been looking for. It has this openness, this approachability, this innocence.
Audio Notes is authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Wu Han, Patrick Castillo, and Isaac Thompson. Additional mastering is provided by Dahong Situ. Musical excerpts on this disc appear courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Johann Sebastian Bach's Second Orchestral Suite, performed by the English Concert, conducted by Trevor Pinnock. Johann Strauss Jr.'s Kaiser Walzer, performed by the Boston Symphony Chamber Players, appear courtesy of Deutsche Grammophon. Online at www.deutschegrammophon.com. Schubert's 6 German Dances are performed by Mitsuko Uchida and is used courtesy of Decca Classics. Debussy's Sacred and Profane Dances, performed by the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sergei Bado, appears courtesy of Superphone Records. Online at www.superphone.com and available for download on iTunes. Bartok's Romanian Folk Dances, performed by the Sofia Soloists, appear courtesy of Centaur Records. Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring, performed by St. Luke's Chamber Ensemble, conducted by Dennis Russell Davies, appears courtesy of Nimbus Records, a member of Allegro Media Group. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Artist Land.